I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about what I want to call augmented generating functions. And combinatorial distance Schrödinger equations. So I'm sorry that I haven't been here the rest of this conference, so I don't know exactly what you guys have already talked about. I'm co-organizer of a summer school on applied combinatorics in Saskatoon, so that's where I've been. But I left it to my co-organizers, and now I'm here to tell you about some things that I think are interesting and I hope you will think are interesting. And so for me, when I was told this conference was going to be about amplitudes, I said, oh, I know something about amplitudes, because to me, amplitudes, if I think about them as, you know, what you get when you sum over appropriate graphs, thinking of them perturbatively, I say, oh, I like them very much. They're an excuse for me to play around with sums of graphs, or sometimes sums of trees if we're trying to keep it simple. And so precisely, how do I want to set this up? So here's the setup I would like to start with. I would like to start with a combinatorial class. And I bet that's the first, you always know what kind of a talk it is by what thing the first symbol is. And I suspect I'm probably the only one for whom the first symbol was a combinatorial class. But bear with me if you don't actually like this kind of discrete stuff. We will do some things with it that I hope you will find interesting. So it's gonna be a combinatorial class. Okay, and for those of you who don't play this game, what do I really mean? I mean a countable set where I have a size function, and there's a finite number, a size function that evaluates in non-negative integers, and there's a positive, there's a finite number of elements of any particular size. So I can form a generating function in the standard way. But I don't want to form the standard generating function right now. I want to actually keep the objects in it. So I want to say, I want to form the following sum. I want to take the elements in my class, but instead of just counting them, I'd like to actually put the element in there. And then I still do want a counting variable, which I guess I'll call x for the time being. And so clearly this is going to be in, well, I've got elements there. Well, for now I've only got just elements, but later on I might want some. So let's say I'm going to take this in a polynomial algebra over the elements of the combinatorial class and then take power series in x. All right? Perfectly sensible place to put something. This is what I mean when I say an augmented generating function, because the actual object's there, not just its size. And then if I want to get to just an ordinary generating function, I need some sort of evaluation map. So this is not interesting in and of itself. Well, kind of is. You could have some interesting recurrences or something. But what's more interesting, especially from a physical perspective, is going to be what I can do with that if I evaluate it, if I have some evaluation map. So, and then I want an evaluation map. Okay, and if my evaluation map, if it just took elements, well, I could just take the guy that maps everything to one, and then I would get usual generating functions. I could do something more complicated. I could map this to polynomials in some other variable, and I could use that to do some refined counting with a second parameter, but I could also think, aha, well, what if my combinatorial class is Feynman diagrams, and my map gives me, is the Feynman rules, give me Feynman integrals, and then I have something that's, well, it's got a lot of parameters, it's very complicated in general, but it's still fitting into this sort of a shape. So more to the point, would be something like, I don't know, where do I want to take it? Well, I guess I could say complex number. Like, there'll be some polynomial in some initial scale variable, and then there'll even be more parameters here, which I don't really care about for the moment, because it'll mostly take a simpler case. where I have Feynman rules. Feynman rules, taking a Feynman graph and some theory. To its interval. And I could be thinking right now of unnormalized Feynman rules, so I really think of this as just a formal integral expression. That's not what I wrote here. This would be, I guess, this might be what it looked like. I could have some regularization in here. This could be after I renormalized. Or instead of this, I could think of some space of formal integral expressions. Or whatever you like, your favorite thing. All right? OK, that's not interesting yet, but it's clear. Is that accurate, you would say? OK, good. It's not meant to be interesting yet. It's meant to be clear. OK. Well, that's kind of boring if I'm allowed to have, you know, do anything. It's not very interesting. And I'd like to spend much of the time here I'm going to spend talking about rooted trees. So I'd like to think about how I might want to specify an interesting combinatorial class with a particular focus on rooted trees. All right, just to be clear, what kind of rooted trees am I going to work with? I'm going to work with rooted trees that don't have restrictions on valence and also don't have a plane structure. I mean, we can talk about all those other options as well, but that's just to be concrete what we're talking about today. So I want rooted trees with no plane structure, no valence restrictions. Okay, so it's just a partial order with a unique root, which I guess if I'm going to draw my trees with the root at the top should be my unique maximal element, no cycles, just trees in that sense. Yes, so and by no plane structure, what I mean is, or another way to say that, is I mean that this tree is equal to that tree. I'm not thinking of an order on the children. All right? And then let's define operation. I guess I should say rooted trees. Let's call this combinatorial class curly T. And then I'd like to have this map B plus. So B plus is going to go from forest. So I guess I'm going to say, let's say here. And what does it do? Well, let's first just define it on a forest. And a forest is equal to a monomial in rooted trees. Well, and then what's that going to be? So here's a bunch of rooted trees. And B plus is going to give me the new rooted tree that has all of those trees as the children of the new root. All right? And really, when it comes down to it, this is what's special about rooted trees. It's not that it's a hugely deep fact, but that's why, you know, if you go and you walk over to your favorite friend who's in computer science, say, and you say, what's so good about rooted trees? Well, what's so good about rooted trees is they're a data structure that naturally has this root, and then you have a recursive, you know, pile of children, whatever additional structure you want to put on them. Right now they're just a pile of them, right? It's just a set, multi-set right now. All right? And if you walk around and ask your favorite combinatorics friend, then in slightly different language, they will say the same thing. And now you guys maybe have more of an algebraic perspective, and you might want to say, well, wait a second, how do I want to think about what's so awesome about this B plus operator? And one of the ways you can think about it is Matilda mentioned briefly the Kahn-Kreimer-Hopf algebra, and in that Hopf algebra, then this B plus is actually a Hochschild-1 cocycle. So And if you look at what that actually means, you actually write out the formula, it's exactly capturing the fact that a rooted tree is made of a root and the forest of its subchildren. So these are all just different ways of capturing the same basic fact that we've just drawn here. Okay, so this is important. And what I want to use it for is to specify or generate interesting combinatorial classes. And I think I'm going to just start with that with an example. So yeah, exactly. So you make, here, I'll do a specific example before I get on to my other example. So if I did B plus of, say, this guy and this guy, then that would be, that would be wrong. This would be this here and then this here because, and I've got colors, so I should use them, except they just went up there. Let's do this example, right? If you have this guy, this guy, and you B plus them, you put a new root, and you make the children of the root, and there can be any number of them, it doesn't have to be any specific n. All right, does that make sense? No, it doesn't. But wouldn't it be obnoxious if I drew it the other way around? I mean, so this is why I say you want to think of this as a monomial. So I'm thinking of a commutative product here, and so this is a commutative product, and so the order doesn't matter here. And that's precisely what's going on. If you would like the order to matter over here, then you need to think of this as a word. So, you know, whichever you like better, it actually makes rather little difference in the end. All right? Questions, comments? I guess I'll keep these colors. You never know when they might come in handy. Okay, that was an example just of B+. Now let's use it to specify a class. And how do I want to do that? Well, I want to write down an equation, something. So here's an example, specification example. And my apologies to, no, I don't think very many, maybe nobody in this audience is, this example comes up a lot, so my apologies to anyone if they've seen it before. I'm not going to call it X. I'm going to call it T. Let's write it like this. 1 plus little x B plus of T squared. Okay. So I need to tell you a few things. I need to tell you what 1 is. And this blackboard bold 1 is my notation for the empty tree. So if you really are thinking of it as monomials, then it really is just 1. But sometimes it's nice to think of it as an empty tree, so I'm going to write it as a blackboard bold 1. But it's just the 1 in this polynomial algebra. Okay, so what does this mean? Let's start working out an expansion of this equation. And you guys can help me along here. So, all right, it starts clearly with 1. All right, and now I'm going to get some terms that are order x. Now, how do I get a term that's order x? Well, here's the x. So whatever's coming out of this B plus, it better not have any x's in it. OK, well, and a B plus is just going to ignore the x. I mean, I didn't explicitly say that, but extend this B plus rather than just on the polynomial algebra over to this just by having it act on the coefficients. And so the only way this is going to work is I better have B plus of whatever I have here that has only a constant term. Well, here's the constant term. Well, I square it, but squaring is 1 squared is just 1. So I have B plus of 1. I mean, why don't you guys tell me, what's B plus of 1? It's a tree with 1 with just a root. Because when I B plus, I take a new root, and I make its children what the argument was. Well, here the argument was nothing at all. So there are no children, but there's still the root. All right? All right, let's do the next couple terms and make sure everybody's on the same page here. What about the x squared term? Anyone want to tell me what I'm going to get there? Well, I'll help you along. So one of the x's is here. So I have to think about what the coefficient of x would be in here and then apply b plus to it. So So I have the coefficient of x and t of x squared. Okay, well, here's t of x. I only need the coefficient of x, so I've got enough of it. I square this. What's the coefficient of x in this first thing squared? Not, someone was giving me two dots. If I had two dots, if I squared this, if I wrote 1 plus x dot, and I squared that, all right, I got a 1. Okay, if I'm going to have two dots, well, that's got to go with the x squared term. That's not the term I want. I want this term in the middle, which is 2x dot. Thank you very much. Okay, now I'd be plus that. The 2 just pulls out. The x just pulls out. We've already got the x there. Here's the 2. And so I have b plus of dot. What's b plus of dot? Yeah, a little stick. Maybe you've already heard me talk about this. Okay. It's not that hard, but you know, not everyone's seen this notation before, and things are always hard the first time you see them, even if they're easy after that. Okay, let's get the x cubed term, and then I think I'll just write down the x 4 term, and then that'll be enough. We'll get the idea of what's going on. So, what is the x cubed term? It's got to come from the x squared term in here. What's the x squared term in here going to be? Yeah, so there's two things, right? There's this part, which we already wrote down, and that's going to give this. But then there's also going to be the part that comes from this part here, and here, and that'll be 4 of those. All right, is that what the rest of you were thinking, just quietly? Questions? Should I just write out the next term?
There wasn't
supposed to be homework.
Why not 4 of
those? Why not 2 of these? Because there's not 2 of them in here. And the fact that I have another term, that doesn't change that, right? So I have 2 of these. And I square all of this. So if you just think of this as a polynomial, I square this, well, I only get 1 copy of dot, dot. And that's how squaring works. Forget about these being dots. Imagine that is like, you know, A1. Right? If I have 1 plus A1x and I square it, I get an A1 squared x squared plus some other terms. All right? Here's the x to the 4 term. So let me do this right. Uh-huh. And so on. Anyone happen? Yes.
So at some point you're putting non-monomials into the B plus, right?
Yes, and it's just behaving linearly with respect to everything else. You're right, I didn't explicitly say that. All right, so for instance, when's the first, 1 case that came up was there's a scalar, it just pulled out. The other case where that came up, I didn't finish this, but the next term in the square here is the this with this, so the 4x squared. So these two guys together, I'd be plus them, and I get those two terms. So it's just acting linearly. Any other questions? Does anyone see what these coefficients are doing? Okay, easier question. You see powers of 2. Good observation. I see powers of 2. And then something else is happening for the other guys, right? But at least I see powers of 2. And so what this is actually doing is this is counting a kind of binary tree where I always keep track of left and right. So what do these coefficients count? And then the next thing you're going to be saying is, why do I care? But we will get to that, I promise. And so let me just do this as an example, since it's not really the central point. Let's take this 4 here. The 4 here is, well, there's one time when it's going right, and there's one time when it goes right-left, and there's a left-left, and there's a left-right. And you can try to play the game similarly for all the others. And unless I made a mistake, it works for all of them. All right? One more example, and then we'll get on to some other stuff. Is that okay with everyone? Here's a second example, and this one's going to come back, so that's why we really want to do this one. And it also has one other feature we haven't seen before. All right, let's expand out this guy. Still starts with 1. Okay, what's the x term? Well, now you got a question of what does this even mean? Okay. So when I write this, this is 1 over 1 minus something. So that, I want you to think of expanding that as a geometric series. Right? Because we're doing series expansion, so that's all we've got. Expand it as a geometric series. Well, the x term, again, that's going to have to come from the constant term. The constant term in the geometric series like this is just 1. So again, the constant term is b plus of 1. And you guys already told me that b plus of 1 was a dot. All right. Don't worry, you only missed things you've already seen before. Anyone want to tell me what the x squared term is? We'll start writing it out. It's going to come, so we've got 1 over 1 minus x dot. That's what we've got so far. There'll be more terms, we don't have them yet. And now if I expand that out, that looks like 1 plus x dot plus x squared dot dot, etc. Okay, and to get the x squared term, one of the x's is from here, so I have to look at the x term here, and I have to b plus that. And so I get just this. But I only get one of them this time. All right. Okay, the x cubed term. What's going to go in there? One of them you should be able to yell off for me. Someone like drew it in the air. It's this guy, right? Because that's already right there. But of course, there'll be another term in the geometric series because there's another term here that we hadn't written in yet because we didn't know what it was. There's this term. And so that'll show up here. And then its square will show up and so on. So this obviously gets, there's lots more stuff here, but we don't care about the rest of it right now because we're just going to put this. We want to b plus that. And we get this. One, two, we don't get that. We get the correct thing. One, two, three. All right, and once again, let me put the x to the 4 term just for your viewing pleasure. And so on. Does anyone want to guess what these coefficients count? There's only one non-1 coefficient. Notice this tree showed up. That tree didn't show up before. Before it was only binary. And in fact, in general, you'll get arbitrary degree trees, because if you just think about expanding the first part of the geometric series, you'll get any power of dot. B plus of that power of dot will give you whatever valence you like. And then recursively, those other valences will also show up further down the tree. What do you think this is doing? Yeah. Specifically, the fact that there's two different plane embeddings of this guy. So that there's two different orders you could choose because they're different subtrees. All right. Questions? Comments? Is this really boring? It's actually fun. I like, but maybe not if you're not of a combinatorics sort of bent, right? I think it's fun. Yes?
Probably a stupid question, but why does the three lines coming from the same node not appear in the initial example?
Because here, after you've B-plussed, you're only ever going to get single trees. So this T is a series that's a sum always with single trees. When I square it, then I can get at most a product of two trees. And when I B-plus a product of two trees, I get something with two trees, two children at the root. It could only have one because of this one here, but either one or two children at the root and never more. If I wanted to get the 3 but not the 4, I could have put a 3 in here. And of course, thinking of this expanded as a geometric series, what I've really done is I put a sum over all the different powers. And so that's why I'm getting all the different powers. All right? I want to think of things that look like this. I want to call them combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equations. And why do I want to call them that? Because you say, well, that's not very nice. Is because if you think of physical Dyson-Schwinger equations, and then if you think about them sort of thinking of their perturbative expansion, what are they? They're some integral equations for Green's function. Well, what makes the game work with Dyson-Schwinger equations is the recursive integral equations, right? The Green's function is appearing inside the integral and on the other side of the equation. And the shape of the recursion is what we're capturing here combinatorially. It's what the trees are capturing. And we'll see a specific example in probably about 15 minutes. But that's what you want to think. We're capturing just the recursive structure that you would see if you were thinking of a Dyson-Schwinger equation applied on a perturbative expansion. Or the perturbative solution to a Dyson-Schwinger equation, or however you want to think about that. All right? Well, now in this language that I started with here, where I started with my augmented generating functions, well, I'm getting those as solutions to these combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equations. Yes? Oh, sorry. Yes, yes. That's the same. I'm thinking of them phrased. Yeah, I mean, you can rephrase it instead as an integral equation, instead of as a differential equation. You're just sort of turning it around, and that's the way I'm more used to thinking of it because I tend to think perturbatively. But yeah, it really is the same equation. It's just packaged in a non-trivially but different way, but fundamentally it's the same thing. There should be, but I'm not going to be able to tell it to you today. So these things, they have these augmented generating series as solutions. And if we apply Feynman rules, which is what I said I wanted to do, right? I wanted to evaluate the augmented generating functions. If you apply it to the combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation, you're going to get something that's not all the way to the Dyson-Schwinger equation you're thinking of, but that's the one step closer, the integral form that I was thinking of. So if you apply Feynman rules to this guy, well, you get an analytic Dyson-Schwinger equation. And we'll see one example later. And then to the solution, of course, you'll get, well, let's say Green's functions, but you know, of course, it depends a little bit what combinatorial class I'm working with. But let's just call them all Green's functions for today. So that's the setup I'm trying to play with here. And now what I'm going to do with this setup is I'm first going to show you a toy, and then I'm going to show you something that's a step closer to the physical situation, and then I will show you one other thing that's related. And that will probably be done for today. And if not, we'll do the rest of it tomorrow. So this is a kind of cool example. So let's, I should say this is, well, there's many people who've contributed, but the part that I worked on was joint with a master's student whose name is Bradley Jones. And so what's going on? Let's take the simplest possible case of what I was talking about before. Well, not the very simplest, but the simplest sort of non-trivial case. And so what is that? Well, this is the case when I want to think of evaluating, so of Feynman rules or evaluation maps, however you want to think of it, that they don't just give one, so we're not just counting, but they just give a number. So we're doing weighted counting. And in fact, this will relate quite nicely to some physical circumstances where you'll be taking the leading log part. So it's the coefficient then of the leading log, and I'm sort of suppressing the actual log itself since it's showing up with the same power as the coupling. Okay, so a simple case of the proceeding would be phi just gives numbers. And this is the leading log of a more realistic case. Okay, and so what's neat about this, and why I wanted to mention it, is this is one of these situations where different groups independently actually got essentially the same result, but in quite different language. So this is something that was studied by the combinatorics community under the name of hook weight formulas or tree hook weight formulas. But it's also something that people in the B-series world or in the Kahn-Kreimer-Hopf algebra world were looking at from their own perspective, closer to the kind of language I've been using. So what my students' work was mainly was actually recognizing that these were really the same language, and they were saying the same thing. So the enumerative combinatorics community studied this independently. And what do they say? Well, how do we set this up? What kind of weights are we looking at? So we want weights with a particular property. So phi just gives numbers, leading log. Specifically, I want phi with the following property. So phi applied to a tree, I want it to be a product over all the vertices in the tree of something, some number that depends only on the size of the subtree rooted at V. So I better say what that is. So where TV is the subtree rooted at V. Did I make my eraser go away? I did. Well, and there's one extremely classical example of this that's actually an exercise in Knuth that everybody knew. It was sort of the starting point for anyone's perspective, and that is the tree factorial. So let's just do this as an example. The simplest possible number that could depend only on the size would be the size. So let's call this is the tree factorial. So let's say tree factorial is the product over the vertices in the tree, size of tree V. Wait, do you want an example? Should we do an example of this? Or is it too easy? Who wants an example? Okay, example. Let's do this tree. Okay, so we have to take a product over all the vertices of the size. So what's the size of the subtree rooted at this vertex? Well, I'm counting vertices, not edges. That's a reasonable answer, but the answer I actually want is 1. I'm going to count my trees by vertices. That's the way, you'll notice that's the way X was counting them. So it's the degree of X. What about this guy? 1. What about this guy? 3, because 1, 2, 3. This guy? 4. All right. This is a hint. If it's ever too boring, you have to yell out the answer really fast, because then we'll move on, right? So the factorial of this tree is 4 times 3 times 1 times 1. That looks like 12 to me. Okay, quick quiz. Which trees would give the usual factorial as their tree factorial? Yes, exactly. Trees that don't have any side branches, that are just lines. So then we just take the product of all the natural numbers up to the size of the tree.
Can you put 4 up there?
4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Because this the subtree rooted here is the entire tree, since this is the root, and it has 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. So when I say the size of a tree, I mean the number of vertices. I should have said that explicitly earlier on, but that's what we've been using all the way along. Some numbers, yeah. I was thinking of it as a coefficient in some formal series, but I mean, it could, you could think of it as some function. It's nice if it's actually a function, because then you can use differential equation techniques. Whereas if it's just some arbitrary series that has no nice analytic properties, then you're kind of left with only series techniques. But yeah, so in general, it could just be a series, but it's nice if it's some nice function. Yes. All right. And so what do you want to do with these? Well, we want to take the, dare I say, Green's function from these Feynman rules, which in the enumerative combinatorics community you would call the hook length series. And so I'll just call that Green's function, because it's the analog, even though it's a strictly simpler case. And so what is it? It's some generating function. It depends on the tree class that we're interested in, and it depends on these weights B. And it's just a sum over the trees in the tree class. I guess I shouldn't have called it B. I called it phi, and sometimes I call it B. Oh, okay, we'll just call it phi of t, but it's the phi that uses that b. You can change your notation if you like. And so there's a community, and what are they interested in doing? Because there's really three pieces of information here, but they're related. There's two independent pieces. There's the tree class, there's the hook weight series, the series of b's, or function if we're lucky, and then there's this thing, this whole thing. And so there was a whole little industry that was about saying, well, what if I have a nice tree class, a nice hook weight formula function, when do I get a nice function here? And nice means one of two things, either a nice closed formula or a nice combinatorial interpretation of the coefficients. So hook weight formulas, so they're nice if FTB has a nice closed form or a nice interpretation. But then if we say this again in our language, what's this really saying? This is saying, well, the nice tree classes, they were coming from these combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equations, and we're thinking of them as representing the nesting structure ultimately of our Feynman diagram. So they're saying something about what kinds of insertions are allowed. Are we doing just vertex insertions or propagator insertions? How many insertion places are there? Things like that. That's our tree class, because that's our combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation. And the B is specifying our quite simplistic, but nonetheless, Feynman rules. And then this would be the Green's function. So this is saying, there was already a world out there that was finding fun little toy models where the leading log expansion had a nice closed form or a nice combinatorial interpretation. All right? So for us, this is saying nice combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equations and nice Feynman rules with nice Green's functions. Okay, and I owe you an example. So I will give you an example, which is not on this page. Well, I could give you that example. I should say some of the names that are associated with this in the combinatorics community. So Posnikoff basically started this off by finding one of these kind of out of the blue, which I could tell you if you care, but I'm guessing you probably don't, the one he did. And then from my perspective, the most important result is of Kuba and Panholzer, because they showed the general form. So I'd said that these three things are related, and sure enough, if you know any two of them, you know the third. And so from a combinatorics perspective, a natural way to write that is a relation in terms of coefficient extraction. It looks kind of like Lagrange inversion. But equivalently, you can write it as a differential equation, which is due to Maza from the B-series community, and special cases of it were known to Eric Panzer and Dirk Kreimer in that community as well. So everyone was really getting the same solution, which is the relationship between those three objects, just in their own language. But they weren't talking to each other, and so that's why Brad figured out how to make them talk to each other and make them use each other's results. And so I want to give you one example. And this example is actually pretty simple, but it's a nice little illustration. So here's an example. Yes.
Get by, you know, kind of organizing trees by the number of vertices they have. Is that right? Because that's half the value of t. Absolute value of t is number of vertices.
Yeah, absolute t is number of vertices, size of t. And then this, they're these kind of weights. They're weights that are built up by the sizes of the subtrees.
Right. Sometimes, normally in Feynman diagrams, you're going to order things by the number of external edges, right?
I think you have a loop expansion. So you want to think of this as representing a loop number, because these trees are representing you don't think of the trees directly as Feynman diagrams. Think of them as representing the divergent structure. So if you have something like this, and you know you have some divergent structure. So here, this would correspond to a rooted tree like this. Now, because I've taken a two loop guy here, you'd have to weight this vertex with two. But if I only use one loop subdivergences, something like that. There's a QED graph. Then that would be something like that. Okay, so this is representing the power in the loop expansion. So it's essentially the coupling constant, right? If you think about it, because the way the graphs are built, since you have only restricted interactions that are possible, the coupling and the loop variables go together. So this is the coupling constant. And then the reason I was saying this is like a leading log term is because if you instead of the coupling substitute in the coupling times the log factor, then this is the leading log part, and it just has a number coefficient. And you would find, in fact, this tree factorial, 1 over tree factorial, always has to show up in a leading log expansion. There can be, of course, other analytic factors that matter, but there's always going to be a combinatorial factor that comes from the 1 over tree factorial. And that's why people on the physics side were thinking about this, because if you think about this first, you can deal with the combinatorial factors that are showing up. And then you can say, okay, what's left? What are the periods that are left, or the numbers that are left, or the other complicated analytic stuff that's left? Without just everything having huge factorial blow-ups and things like that. Does that answer your question?
I didn't follow the details, but I was trying to find, yeah, okay, I believe what you're saying. So why do you have a root? Is it sort of
Yes. So you only get to go from Feynman diagrams to trees directly if you have a situation where the divergences are either disjoint or nested. If you have overlapping divergences, you have to do a little more work. You have to expand it as a sum of the different ways of resolving the overlap, if you want to think of it as a tree. You can also work directly on Feynman diagrams, of course. But I wanted to keep things simple with a tree setup. So in the tree setup, then you need to think of resolving overlaps by the different possible ways of inserting. Is that good?
So basically, there is a way just to honestly get Feynman diagrams, but if you set up the right dictionary.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Okay. Was that helpful for other people? Make sense? Okay. Example. So here's an example. Let's say, let's start with my t of x is going to be 1 minus x b plus of 1 over t squared, t of x squared. Okay. And then let's take the Feynman rules just to be the 1 over tree factorial, or to put in the log explicitly, if L is my log factor, let's call it L to the size of tree over tree factorial. Okay? And that, like I was saying, even in the real Feynman diagram computations, you'll always have this combinatorial factor as well as, you know, all your other physical stuff. Then, the Green's function, let's call it g of x l, so my coupling and my scale variable, is just 1 minus 3 alpha x l to the 1/3. So it's a simple toy. It's not too surprising it has a simple solution, but that's a nice little solution. And if you think back to what this is going to mean in terms of tree insertions, and that's a nice way, this is related to your question, sometimes we had examples which we erased where we had something appearing with a power, like a squared, a positive power. And then sometimes we had them appearing like that, like 1 over x. Well, the 1 over x, because it's a geometric series, that's corresponding to a propagator insertion. And showing up just as a power is corresponding to a vertex insertion. So this is showing up twice in the denominator. So that's corresponding to a situation where you have 2 propagator insertions. So this would correspond to a situation like, say, in a scalar phi cubed theory, where you can insert this graph into itself in either propagator. So not a super interesting case, but you know, something that does show up. If you have 2 propagator insertions, then this combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation will build all your subdivergent structures, all your trees. And then here's a simple Feynman rule, and here's a solution. L is my scale variable. So if you think of this, there's some momentum q, and then your L would be your log. And you're going to subtract at a, you're going to renormalize by subtracting at some fixed reference scale. Then this would be your log q squared over mu squared.
That means that G is the solution of the equation.
Yes, G is the solution of the weighted equation you get out of this. It's the F, essentially. There's a difference of whether you have a constant term or not. It's off by a constant term from that F defined there. Yes, exactly. They're this class of trees. Comments?
Here in this format, this T has trees with coefficients, right?
T has trees with coefficients. Yes. So there's 2 different ways you could think about this. So I was saying pick an underlying class of trees, and then you can then have some other class that's appearing when you project it onto the first class as trees with coefficients. So let's take a specific example. Remember how when I did 1 over x, that tree was showing up with a 2? So instead of thinking of it this way, as I have an underlying class of trees where I don't care about the planar structure, but this tree is showing up twice, I could say, no, I want to take the class of trees where I care about the planar structure. And those are equivalent from my perspective, because when I evaluate with these Feynman rules that only depend on the size of the subtrees, I don't really care about the planar structure, but I do really want that tree to show up twice, because that's really corresponding to 2 different Feynman diagrams. You know, something like this versus this. They evaluate the same way, which is what they should do, but they're not actually the same if you think about fixing the external legs. Exactly, which it should.
So in the definition, it's implicit, but when you do the sum over each tree in the class T, you're really doing the sum over the things that appear in this series.
Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah, so here you'd have to think of it as a weighted sum where you weight with the coefficients that show up in this solution. But it ends up being the same thing because it's only the shape of the tree that matters for these rules. All right, comments? Should we do something slightly closer to physics? All right, yes? No, go home, Karen, go away. oh yeah, this is the right page. I guess I'm up there.
Can you say a little bit, what did you mean when you said that G is different from F?
I think it might actually be the same the way I defined it. There's an issue about whether you want to actually have an empty tree in your class. And some schools of thought don't like to have an empty tree in your class, so your series will always start with X, and some schools of thought would like there to be one. And I don't remember which way, I mean, clearly this one has the one, and I guess the way I defined it today, this one had the one, but the way it was in the paper, that one didn't have a one, and so... it's just sort of a little offset. And if you think these are cool, there's a whole table of different examples that you can build, some of which were already known in the combinatorics community, and some of which are new. So. If you want to get a catalog of different examples, you can look up Brad's master's thesis. So here's something a little closer to what you might think of in terms of Dyson-Schwinger. In this particular example, well, the way I'm going to discuss it is due to an old paper of David Broadhurst and Dirk Kreimer. But I mean, it's not their question, it's sort of their answer, maybe. Okay, so I'm going to normalize my Green's functions to start with 1. So I'm always normalizing the tree term to 1, but that's just me being a silly mathematician. That doesn't have any deep significance. I'll tell you what this is in a second. It's nothing state of the art or anything, but I hope it will show you a little bit closer what I'm trying to talk about. And I'm being a mathematician and I'm putting norm k squared. It's just, but you know what I mean. Same thing. And then I've got a k plus q squared and minus the same thing evaluated at q squared equals mu squared. And I better close the parentheses. Okay? So this is what I meant by, this is just one particular example. What is this? This is, in Yukawa theory, it's just insertions of this diagram into itself. Okay? And this is one way you could think about in physical terms the Dyson-Schwinger equation that describes the piece of Yukawa theory given by just this guy inserted into itself in all possible ways. So I'm not writing it in the differential form that you were talking about, but I'm instead writing it as an integral equation. But it's just another form for it. And you'll notice if you think about what rooted trees you could get, you can only insert this guy down here, and you can insert it any number of times. That's a geometric series. So this is actually exactly this tree equation. L, if you think about the scaling, L will come out. So the way this has to scale, notice there's all these Q's in here because the Q is the external momentum. And if you think about how it has to scale, because I'm evaluating the same thing at this subtraction point, it can only depend on log q squared over mu squared, and that's L. Comments? You're dubious. You look really dubious. Like, you know, erase a board and let you think about it. Maybe I won't erase that board because that's our example, not that part of it. Okay, now I don't actually want it to look like that because I don't like that. All right. Okay. I'm not going to do all the details then. So I don't want it to look like this. I would like to transform it to look like something else that I would like better. Right? And that's sort of a standard story. So what do I want to do with this? Do the following. And these are I'm just talking about standard tricks. I'm not talking about doing anything super clever. So do the following to this equation. Because I don't really want all that stuff in there. What am I going to do? So first, I'm going to expand out G as a series. Because you know what? I already said at the beginning, I really like series. Because I like to think of them as generating functions. So I'm happy to have a series. Okay. So there it is as a series in L. That's my log log expansion. Well, not quite, but anyway, that's my expansion in L. Okay, and now what am I going to do? I don't think I'm going to do it here for you today, so it's sort of an exercise to actually do these things, but I'll tell you what the answer is, because you're going to now have a sum inside here, and you can also expand this as a geometric series. So expand this, plug in and expand the geometric series. And then you're going to get a big sum in here in this integral, and I want you to swap them next. So, and the convergence is okay, so you can do that.
What is G?
Well, I want to think of it as a formal series in two variables. I like to think of it as a formal series, so I don't really care where my variables are. But if you would like to put your variables somewhere, yeah, making them real variables would be reasonable. In fact, I would like to put it in a power series ring. Yes, that's what I mean by I'd like to make it formal variables.
Alpha is a constant.
Which you notice used to be x.
And q is some kind of external momentum.
Yes, q is the external momentum.
So how many is this a Green's function for how many particles?
This is just for this guy, right? So there's only one. I'm doing a very simple case where there's only one kinematical parameter because there's just the momentum flowing through the graph. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the renormalization is occurring. Here's the subtraction for the outer divergence, and the rest of the renormalization is happening recursively because of the recursive appearance of this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, alpha is the coupling constant, and L is my one kinematical parameter. So I have to say, honestly, I would still like to see it as a formal series because, as typically happens with perturbative expansions, it's going to be a divergent series. So analytically, it's a piece of garbage. But we're still here doing physics, so we're still going to write it down. And I want to think of it as a formal series, but if you want to think of it as something and you're going to apply a Borel transform or something like that, like you can play analytic games, but you've got to work harder because it's divergent. Does that answer? I didn't really answer your question the first time. Is that okay now? Okay. Anyone, any other comments or questions? All right. Okay, what are we going to do? So I'm telling you how to make this nice. So we're going to do that. Now what's the next thing we're going to do? You'll notice there's going to be a lot of logarithms around. There's going to be all sorts of logs of k squared. And I don't really want those logs of k squared. So I'm going to use the fact that I can get a logarithm from taking a derivative of a power. So if I take I derivatives, I guess rho to the I at this point, rho I, of y to the minus rho, and then evaluate that at rho equals 0, then that's going to be a power of log. In particular, it's going to be I powers of the log of y. And there's a sign in here, so it's going to be that. So use that everywhere you see a logarithm. That's the next step. And then you've got this these derivatives, and you've got still this integral, and the sum, actually, you've got, do I need to worry about the sum? No, just the integral, swap. So I want to swap the integral and the d by d rho. And then if you actually do all this work, you'll notice that this expansion kind of didn't do anything. It was just hanging around. And so the fifth step is undo the expansion. Now let me tell you what that gives. Eraser. So what that gives is we get that GXL or alpha L, I called it alpha, didn't it? That was is something like this. And then here, instead of having some reasonable thing, I'm going to have a differential operator. Well, I've got to put the minus sign somewhere, so I'm going to put it in there. All right? So if you do all that work, this is what you get. And this is the form that I would like to use. I think we're now at least three steps away from what you would normally think of as a Dyson-Schwinger equation in physics, but we're really talking about the same thing. We've just reformulated it now in a more substantial way. And this is a format that I like because it's well suited to the kind of series expansion games that I like to play. All right? And now I think I will check the time, and then I will tell you what I can do with this and what I and some students have done with it. All right? Yeah. So think about this. This is a series. Remember, I like to work with formal series. This is a series in L and rho, okay? Bivariate series. And now this is, there's a differential operator in rho. So if I expand this out, I'm always going to expand out my G, and then expand this out as a geometric series. So this is going to be, if you will, a series in alpha and this rho derivative. Okay, and now what do I mean by taking this and this? I mean to apply this, so term by term, apply this differential operator with the appropriate coefficient, which is some polynomial in alpha, to this series. So take the appropriate derivatives of rho. And then ultimately, once you've done all that, set rho equals zero. So you're just taking the matching terms where the power here matches.
1 over g, and then you plug in. What's that inverse?
Yeah, because remember, g starts 1 over 1 minus something. So yeah, 1 over g is 1 over 1 minus something. So it's a sensible thing to expand just as a geometric series.
All right. What was capital F?
What was capital F? Aha! I have to tell you what capital F is, and I'm sorry that I didn't, because I should have said that up here. What is capital F? So if you do all this, there's going to be some junk left over. The junk left over is f, but it's not actually junk. All it is it's the integral for just the primitive, regularized by raising where the insertion, the propagator you're inserting in to the power rho, to the power one, like a, instead of being squared, it's going to be 2 plus rho. Okay? So that's one thing I like about this set of transformations, is it actually very naturally regularizes for you. Rather than putting in a regularization artificially, it actually shows up automatically from this step. So f of rho, this is the integral for, well, there's only one sort of basic primitive graph we're built out of. So it's the integral for this one with this propagator, the one we're inserting in, regularized by rho. Okay? And I'm going to think of it just again as a series expansion in rho. In this case, it will have a simple pole. And in fact, we'll see in a moment that when I set up my slightly more general case, I'll allow this to be an arbitrary series that's a Laurent expansion with a simple pole in rho. And I'm just sort of imagining that the physicist told me what it is. It's the only piece of analytic input that we need in the end. And then we just play this series game on what's left. All right, thank you. That was a very good question, which I should have said. Any other questions before I tell you what I can do with this? Okay. So, well, slightly more generally, we can think about something similar where I'm now allowed to have more than one basic, more than one primitive, and then this will appear to a matching power. So I will have something like k greater than or equal to 1, there'll be an alpha k, there'll be a g alpha still with this derivative in here, and it's now going to be raised to the power 1 minus sk, where s is a parameter that's telling you something about what power the insertion is occurring to, and k is the loop order of the primitive, and then there'll still be an e to the minus l rho minus 1. That's coming from the overall scaling behavior. That's where the L is coming out of the primitive here. And then there'll be a different FK rho for each K. And so from my point of view, I just want FK rho. I want to think of it as some power series expansion, I starting at negative 1. So there's some little FKI row, I'm going to start I at 0 because later on I'm going to want the indexing to go that way. So then we'll have to say I minus 1 there. Okay? And this covers a slightly wider class of things. Now, what can I do about this? So with an ex PhD student, a finished PhD student, Nicolas Marie. And so that's for the case S equals 2, K equals 1. And in general, with Marcus Hinn, who just needs to finish writing, so he needs a kick in the butt to finish writing it up. You all know how that is sometimes with students. I'm going to say solve. Of course, it's not the solution you would really like physically. You would like an analytic solution, and I can't do that. But what I can give you is I can give you a series solution that's not just some horrible mess, but that's indexed in some quite transparent way by some nice combinatorial object. Okay? And you say, wait. We already had that. That's what we started with. These trees are Feynman diagrams. But no, that's not the answer, because then you had to apply your Feynman rules, and they're non-trivial, right? I'm saying I'm going to have an expansion that's in both the L and the alpha, an expansion that's really, it's just a combinatorial coefficient. There's nothing else going on. And so I think that's fun and interesting, even though it's only the sort of solution that a series person would like. So. We have a series solutions which are nice. And I will tell you what I mean by nice in the next couple of minutes. So I think I'm going to jump right to the chase and actually tell you what the answer is. So namely, here's what it looks like. So this G of alpha L, it looks like a sum. So the L part is actually not very interesting, is the least interesting part. It's just showing up sort of exponentially, right, with a I factorial. And now there's a sum over C is going to be over rooted connected chord diagrams. I'll tell you about that in just a second. X to the size C. F of C, what is that? That's a monomial. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm only going to write it on the board in the case S equals 2, K equals 1, because otherwise it's just going to get messy, okay? Namely, for S equals 2, K equals 1, it's going to look like this. And in general, it's not worth handwriting on the board, but it's not hard. It just has some extra weights. F at BC minus I. So in general, just some extra weights. And it's messier. That's old. Okay, where, I have to tell you about a lot of things. Where, so the sum runs over rooted connected chord diagrams. Okay, what's that? Okay, well, a chord diagram is what you think. It's a circle with some chords, right? That's a chord diagram. What does it mean that it's rooted? Rooted means that there's a distinguished vertex, and I actually am going to mean a distinguished orientation as well, all right? So if you don't like thinking of it as chord diagrams, you can really think of it as just a matching along a line. All right, so here's my root, and this is the root orientation. Okay, what does connected mean? Connected means, well, intuitively, this is connected, but something like this, something that's so badly drawn, no one can tell what it is. Something like this is not connected. Precisely, if you define the intersection graph, which is you have a vertex for each chord, and the vertices are joined by an edge if they cross, it's saying that the intersection graph is connected. All right, so this is connected. This is not connected. This is the root, root vertex, and also then the root chord. All right, so that's what the sum is over. Okay, and the size of C, which is showing up, is the number of chords. Okay, so this guy has size 3. And this guy doesn't count because it's not connected, but if it did, it would have size 4. All right. And now that's all pretty straightforward. We need the one tricky thing, which is there's a natural order on the chords just induced from the counterclockwise order on the chord diagram, or from the order on the matching, if you think of it as a matching of you know, 1 through 2n. But that's not the order I actually want to use. So need what I'm going to call the recursive chord order. And how does that go? Well, the root chord is 1. And then if you remove the root chord, you'll in general get some connected components. And now I want to recursively, so next order all the guys in C1, next put all the guys in C2, et cetera, into my order. So order C1, next C2, et cetera. And that definitely calls for an example, so here we go. This is the first example where something non-trivial happens. All right, and let's go through and actually label up this guy altogether. So where should I put, what's chord number 1? Someone tell me where chord number 1 is in this chord diagram. It's kind of actually hard to tell when you make a thing, but it's this one, okay, right? That's what you meant, right? Okay, now if I remove that, there's 2 connected components. Here's one of the connected components. Right? That's connected if I remove the root. Here's the other connected component. And now I want to label these connected components following the same rule, but following it recursively. So the next thing I want to do is label everything in here. Okay, so the 2 is going to go here, but now where's the 3? What color is the 3?
Blue.
This is chord 3. And then, now that I'm done numbering this connected component, now I finally get to number this connected component. So you see, this is the smallest chord diagram where this recursive chord order doesn't actually match the counterclockwise order, because often it does for small examples. But in general, it can be quite different. All right? So that was the one technical annoying thing. Now that we have that, everything is easy enough to finish stating. So oh, X is alpha. Oh, thank you. Let's fix that. Is everything else right? L is L. B, C, I, I think that's all right. The Fs, yeah, I'm getting there, but I needed the recursive chord order first. So remember we said the only analytic information we needed to keep was the Laurent expansion of the F. And because I've only written it on the board in the case of just one F, I have the F of rho. This was my my result of integrating a regularized primitive is F0 rho to the minus 1 plus F1 plus F2 rho, et cetera. So I have a Laurent expansion for it. And now I'm going to use these coefficients f. I'm going to build monomials out of them to get those f's up there. So specifically, we say a chord is terminal if everything it crosses occurs before it in the recursive chord order. Okay, and so if we let T1, T2, all the way to some TS be the terminal chords, then that BC, that's, I guess, the bass chord. It was originally the bad chord, because when I first worked all this out, the terminal ones were bad, and that was a bad chord. Anyway, it's just T1. And I guess I'm saying it's index, right? It's number in the recursive chord order. And F sub C, so that means F sub BC minus I is just a particular FI. It's just some individual FI. And this guy is going to be a monomial. And the monomial it is specifically is F TS minus TS minus 1, and so on. So just differences. F T3 minus T2. FT2 minus T1, and then finally, I need to make it, the result is going to be homogeneous in any given degree, so I need to put enough powers of F0 to fix the homogeneity, and the correct number of powers is size of C minus, ooh, I shouldn't have called that S, because there's another S in the picture. Let's call it L. Doesn't really matter, right? It's just a little number. L. Okay? Okay, so that's a little messy to write down all the details, but what's the take-home message here? The take-home message is you start with a Dyson-Schrödinger equation that's at least only a small step away from something that truly would be a physical example of a Dyson-Schrödinger equation. You play around with it a bit, and then you can have a fairly explicit combinatorial expression for a series solution to it. Because if you think about what's going on in here, well, that F, that whole conglomeration with those Fs, that's just a monomial determined by the chord diagram. And so each chord diagram determines a monomial in the Fs, in the coefficients of the series expansion of the primitive, and then they just get put together by summing over the chord diagrams. That's all that's going on. And you can also see that looking at higher powers of L is actually just sort of truncating, right? I mean, it's not quite that because of the BC minus I, but it's not fundamentally using different pieces. Which, of course, we should know from the renormalization group equation, but there's a very explicit manifestation of it. So that's kind of cool. And furthermore, if we understood the asymptotic distribution of the core of the terminal chords, then we could understand some asymptotics on this and maybe actually do something that would really be interesting, like say something about the analytic solution. But that's still a good step away from where we are at the moment. Let's see, I have 10 minutes. So I'll tell you what I'm going to talk about next, and you can tell me if you'd like to hear about the first part of it now or if you'd like to wait until tomorrow. So I'll give, I guess, call this a little outline of tomorrow. I wanted to say one more thing about these expansions that come from Dyson-Schrödinger equations or that come from leading log expansions and things like that. Yes, sorry, good time for a question. Just finished this. Yeah, it's sort of a section too. This example. This example is big enough that it has its own section.
Right. This is an example. I could really think that it is an example of a renormalized amplitude. It's a computation of amplitude.
Yes.
It just happens to be, as you said.
It's a little bit of a silly amplitude, yeah, because it's just a 2-point. It's just a 2-point, and it's not. Remember, not every possible subdiagram occurred. It really is a simplification because we're only making it of insertions of that one primitive into itself.
And so, in the context of, let's say, what the best question to ask about this example is, but in the context of that theory, say, mm-hmm. how does it compare to the computation of other amplitudes? Does it simplify kind of the other questions about, I mean, the other amplitudes from the same theory? How does it fit into the bigger picture of that theory, say?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So ultimately, what you would want is systems of equations like this, because you'd want to be inserting You know, you don't just want, when you think of building up to the graphs for your two-point function, you need to also do vertex insertions. And so then you also need to have an equation for the three-point and, you know, et cetera, whatever needs renormalization in your theory. I guess just the one and the two and the three in this case, or the two different twos and the three. So what you would actually have in the physical case is you would have a system of equations like this, which you would want to solve simultaneously. I haven't worked out exactly how that is going to work yet. I'm fairly confident the overall shape is going to be quite similar. So you could sort of think of this is the first step towards writing down what the general solution would look like. And it should, given that this and this really make almost no difference whatsoever, I would strongly suspect that the general case is going to have a very similar overall shape. It's going to be more complicated weights, and of course there's more variables going on because you've got more kinematical parameters. It's going to get a lot messier, but I think it should have a similar shape.
And a related question is, would this qualify as a non-perturbative definition of this
amplitude? Well, then I go right away and expand it again as a series. So just this equation, you might be able to justify that. But then all the things I do after that, no, and not really, because I'm still working in a series expansion. You could hope to get back to that, though, if you had some asymptotic information about the gaps of chord diagrams. And that's the kind of combinatorial question you might be able to, well, I'm working with a postdoc who's a pure combinatorics guy, because they do have a number of fairly powerful tools for understanding asymptotics of various substructure, like, you know, various parameters on combinatorial classes. So if you could understand that, then you could maybe get some estimates that would get us back to a non, you know, truly back to a non-perturbative situation. If you could solve this directly, which, you know, maybe if rho was extra nice, or f of rho was extra nice and things like that, then you really would have a non-perturbative solution. And for example, I said this particular little piece of Yukawa theory came from an old paper of David Broadhurst and Dirk Kreimer. And so there, it's a particular thing. So f of rho is explicit. It's just a geometric series, actually. And in that case, using a fair bit of work, they could actually solve this non-perturbatively. So you can sometimes do it. There's not a lot of hope, I don't think, for a general expression for it, because, you know, the special functions just aren't there. But maybe you could understand something about the general behavior of it, even if you can't write down a closed form or anything. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Any other? If you ask enough questions, then the answer of, well, should I say the next thing, is definitely no, right? All right. Is there no more questions? Let me at least summarize what I was going to say. Oh, you got a question. That looks like a question.
I guess a quick one. S. Is there a physical interpretation for S? Or?
Yes, but it would take a little bit of time to get into it. S is basically. Okay. Let's for the moment just think about propagator insertions. Okay. So they're always showing up as geometric series. So S is basically one more than how many propagator insertions you have. Why that's a sensible parameter would take a little more work to get into, but that's essentially what it is. So when I say S equals 2, that's because I'm looking at this case, but I'm only inserting in this guy. There's one propagator that I'm fundamentally inserting into. I mean, once I work at it recursively, I can have many insertions into it, but there's a oneness here, right? If I had S equals 2, sorry, if I had S equals 3, that would be two propagators I was inserting into, and so on. And if I have a negative S, that's going to correspond to vertex insertions, but it's a. And why it's off by one is basically just because I did that a long time ago, and then you get stuck.
Does this Mr. overlapping?
Yeah. So if you want to have more overlapping cases, they're going to show up as more primitives, right? Because if I have. There's two parts to that question. Some things are going to show up as more primitives, and otherwise, if you want to have overlapping situations, then to set it up in this language, you need to make all the algebraic theory work. Then in the underlying Hopf algebra, whatever your primitive things are, they have to be Hochschild 1 cocycles. If you have overlaps, then that's only going to work correctly if you mod out by the appropriate relations. And that's where things like Walter von Suhlkamp showed that the word identities correspond to a co-ideal that you can mod out the Hopf algebra by if you take the Feynman diagram Hopf algebra for QED, say. And so you can deal with the overlapping, but it's like a big long story. I can't just do it right here. And so what I've actually written on the board at the moment does not deal with overlapping, because I'm only dealing with the graphs that I generate with that particular recursive shape, and that doesn't generate anything like that in these cases. But it is possible. It's just a digression that I'm not going to go into. All right, so I guess I will stop there then, and tomorrow you will hear about one more thing about series expansions, and then I will play with individual graphs and some things that relate to some of the stuff Matilda was telling us about.
There are some extra questions. Okay, so actually, building up on Marco's question, there are certain field theories, like two-dimensional field theories, where you know the S matrix, not perturbatively true,
yep.
Some Young-Baxter type equations. Can you try to reconstruct the S matrix of those theories, which you know what it is, this way? And
that's a really good question. You should be able to, but I haven't gone and done that. But that's a really good idea. The one thing that has been done that's not exactly that, but that's getting, well, it's not really that. Never mind.
Any more ideas or questions? Suggestions for future work? If not, just let me remind you that the reception will be at 7 p.m. in a black hole bistro, which is on the top floor. I guess we're on the top floor.
No, I think it's on the second floor.
Oh, it's on the second floor.
So you just go up one flight of stairs and you will see there's a clear area where there will be tables.
Yes. Okay, so 7 p.m. And let's. Thanks for the.